Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 326. Whoa. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com, stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowisogay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. What a fun show we have for you this week. We must get started with our guest. Mark Aceto is an award-winning and best-selling novelist. He's a playwright, a professor, a librettist, a radio voice, an essayist, and so much more. His celebrated comic novel, one of my favorites, How I Paid for College, a novel of sex, theft, friendship, and musical theater, was called a witty high school romp by the New York Times and led to the celebrated sequel, Attack of the Theater People. Mark also wrote the revised book to the classic Lerner and Lowe musical, Paint Your Wagon, which was at City Center Encores, and the musical, A Room with a View, based on that incredible text. His comedy, Birds of a Feather, won the Helen Hayes Award for Best New Play and has been produced by theaters all around this great country. In addition, his essays have appeared in the New York Times and a ton of other publications. He regularly contributes to Playbill magazine. His syndicated column, The Gospel According to Mark, ran in over a dozen gay publications for many years, and he's been a regular contributor to NPR's All Things Considered. He is no stranger to radio. He wrote the book to the New York-bound musical Chasing Rainbows about the young life of Judy Garland, which will have its world premiere production at the Flat Rock Playhouse in Flat Rock, North Carolina in November. And to top it all off, Mark is making his Broadway debut this season as the librettist of the new musical Allegiance, which opens pretty darn soon. But first, he is here with us. Mark, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you. I will say right off the bat that Allegiance also stars George Takei, who, of course, is really gay.
Very gay.
We all know he is. It is so much so that he says it's okay to be Takei. So clearly, I'm destined for being on this show.
You are. We're thrilled to have you. So much ground to cover. Are you ready?
I'm ready. Let's hit the ground running.
So our crack research reveals a fellow New Jersey native. Is that correct?
Indeed. Yeah, I grew up in a little town called Westfield, which is a bedroom community of Manhattan, which means, I guess, people sleep there a lot or sleepwalk through their lives.
I know it well. Did little Mark Aceto always have a pen in his hand? That's what I have pictured.
No, little Mark Aceto was always on stage and was the lead in his high school plays. And I didn't actually start writing until my senior year of high school. I did a final project for AP English that was a one-man show that was called Edward the Boy. Don't ask me why I decided that my alter ego would be named Edward. I just liked it. So I mean, you can ask me if you'd like, but the answer is I don't know. So I did this one-person show that was about a young man who wanted to go to college to be an actor, and his father didn't want him to be. It was based on my real-life experience. And I kind of tucked that away for a long time afterwards, because I was pursuing a career as an actor and then as an opera singer. But eventually it all came around, and I returned to that story, which was this, you know, semi-autobiographical story that became How I Paid for College.
Nice. Now, I have to ask, what was the star Mark Aceto turn on stage there in high school?
Star Mark Aceto turn, my good. Well, first off, if I might say, there were many, just so you know. So I was, you know, I ubiquitously the leading man, you know, throughout junior high and high school. I'd just like to say that. I was Teen Angel, which was not the leading man because, of course, I was never butch enough to play Danny Zuko, but I wear that role like a badge of honor. You know, Jesus and Godspell, Pippin and Pippin. You know, Albert and Bye Bye Birdie. That was the summer that I decided I would be an actor. Summer I was 14 and played the lead in Bye Bye Birdie. And that was the summer that Fame came out, Do the Math.
It was just like 3 years ago.
Yes, exactly. So I just decided at that point, yes, I am going to go to the High School of Performing Arts and I'm going to be an actor and all of that. And of course, I didn't go to the High School of Performing Arts. Although now my husband and I are big supporters of LaGuardia High School. So, in fact, they are our beneficiaries because we have no children. So we, in a way, have adopted LaGuardia High School.
It's an incredible place. I worked for a year, years ago, for the School of American Ballet, and so many of our students there at the School of American Ballet were day students at LaGuardia, and what an incredible experience that those kids had.
Amazing. You know, and they had the longest school day of any high school in the country. Enormously high SAT scores, and yet they need an incredible amount of support because it's a public school, but they need, you know, a lot of extra support because of all the things that they do.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's why we decided to adopt them.
I love it.
My kids.
Now, in your intro, I said you're a novelist, a playwright, a professor, a librettist, a radio voice, an essayist. Is there one word that you gravitate towards more than the others?
At this point, it is definitely playwright.
Yeah.
Librettist. You know, certainly librettist right now, because, of course, that's, you know, what I'm primarily doing. But there are, you know, a number of plays that are sort of hovering in the wings, so that, you know, in terms of which one dominates could be a question in the year or two to come. But librettist was my midlife crisis.
Right.
You know, I came to New York 5 years ago, determined to reinvent myself and to write Broadway musicals. I was absolutely fixated on creating uplifting, serious stories that inspire. You know, all too often I feel like you either get serious musicals that can be nihilistic and depressing, or you can get, you know, uplifting, fun musicals that are, you know, featherweight.
Right.
But to be able to, in the Oscar Hammerstein tradition, tell a story that's serious and substantive and yet has an authentic joy to it, is, I think, something that is increasingly rare. And as an artist, it's absolutely what I want to put in the world. So I came here to do that. And invariably, actually, Allegiance found me. I did not originate the project. I was asked to come on to it. And it turns out there's this magnificent true story that is, you know, so incredibly uplifting and inspiring.
How do you sign on to a project that has as its roots this reality, this, you know, nonfiction aspect to it? Because, as you said, this had some pre-existing content that you had to join midstream.
Do you know, it's interesting you should say that, because now in retrospect, I realize for the most part, I'm attracted to true stories.
Yeah.
You know, if you think about how I paid for college and Attack of the Theater People, which are, you know, two of the major accomplishments I've had in terms of writing, both, of course, are based on my life. So while they're not based on history, but they are based on my history.
Right.
So they are actually drawn very much from real life, even though I basically recast my real life as sort of, you know, Ferris Bueller. Although, I don't know, I could argue that my adolescence was, you know, very similar to Ferris Bueller. So,
you know, wow.
What can I say? And then on top of that, you know, Birds of a Feather, which is the play you referenced earlier, is based on true events. So I find actually now that almost everything I'm writing is a story that you don't know about a story that you do know.
Nice.
You know, there's sort of these hidden gems inside these other stories. You know, in the case of Chasing Rainbows, for instance, it's about Judy Garland's adolescence, everything prior to The Wizard of Oz, which is, you know, when they do television movies of it, it's, you know, 20 minutes, a half an hour, and then we get to, you know, the pill popping.
Right.
And there's a whole other story and a really interesting backstory there where, you know, this is a little girl at the height of the Depression who supported her entire family and did so at a time when her father unexpectedly died and left her to be essentially bullied at work. So there's a really interesting story there that doesn't usually get a full treatment.
Yeah.
Same thing, of course, with the Japanese-American internment. A lot's been written about it, but it has not been dealt with in the mainstream culture in this particular kind of way before.
Yeah. Well, let's start with Judy Garland before we move on to Allegiance. You know, we had Seth Sykes on the show a few weeks ago, and he had his one-man mm-hmm. show in New York about Judy Garland. I have to pose to you the question I asked to him as the definitive guest right now, right this second, on Judy Garland, because you're on the episode this week. What is it, Mark Aceto, with the gays and Judy Garland? I feel like you are in the position to definitively answer
yeah,
this.
Absolutely. It is about both being an outsider and a misfit, and the fact that she had this incredible vulnerability that everyone could identify with, but particularly, you know, the gays.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there was this sort of triumphant, clarion life force that came out of her, and that continually you know, every time she was knocked down, she would get back up again. You know, and eventually she was knocked down, and that's the end of the story. And unfortunately, right. we view the life, I think, by this way the story ended, which is a typical way to view the story.
Right.
But the fact is, what we don't see is the resilience that predominated. So I think that's the gay thing. The thing that I was drawn to, though, about the story, well, twofold. One, I have a very long history with Judy Garland, which I'm happy to share with you. But the other piece that I'll just say in terms of what I was approaching it recently was that if you talk to anybody who actually knew her, who, you know, in interviewing those people, the first thing they always say is, you have no idea how funny she was.
Hmm.
I think because the tragedy predominates.
Right.
But by all accounts, she was hilarious. And as somebody who has a light touch myself and a comic touch, that was really appealing to me, to actually say, no, how can we never see the story where she is hilarious? We only see this, you know, this sort of soulful, vulnerable figure that we see on the screen, and not the sort of wisecracking jokester who, you know, kind of just pitbulled her way through life to be able to predominate. So that's a lot of what we see in this particular take, is another side of this woman that has not been portrayed before.
Wow. I would imagine that's going to be quite the part for someone to play, as it is right now, that lead in Chasing Rainbows.
Yeah, right now, we actually have this 18-year-old girl who is a dead ringer, both vocally and physically.
Wow.
For Judy. So we consider ourselves very lucky, and she is aptly named Ruby.
Oh, gosh.
So we considered it really serendipitous that we found Ruby Rakos who has been doing the show in workshops for us and will now do the world premiere production.
I don't know what the next level is after serendipitous, but I would go for that level for having someone named Ruby play this part, Mark.
Don't you think? Well, I have a longstanding Judy fixation, which, of course, you know, as a gay man is not uncommon, particularly a gay man of a certain age.
Right.
But it is one of my earliest childhood memories is of Judy Garland seeing The Wizard of Oz when I was 3. And shortly afterwards, my father was reading the obituaries, and as is his wont in the morning. And my father would always say, you know, if his name's not in the paper, then he knows it's going to be a good day. So he always starts with the obituaries. And so he was reading the obituaries. I'm 3.5 years old. I'm eating Cheerios with my fingers, which I still do. And he turned to me and he said, remember Dorothy in that movie you just watched? And I said, uh-huh. And he said to me, she's dead.
Oh.
And it tells you something about how my dad rolls. So, but in my mind, it made this lifelong connection between the afterlife and Oz.
Oh, wow.
And the notion of singing over the rainbow being that you would be singing for longing for someone that you lost. And so, of course, when I discovered that Judy Garland had lost her father and that there was this deep connection, that he was a closeted gay man and the love of her life, it really crystallized to me the notion of what this song really signifies and what it's about for her.
I'm still on the part where I'm trying to figure out if I want your dad to break bad news to me or not. It might be good, but I don't know. I get the whole ripping the Band-Aid off, but I don't know. I don't know on that one. What are you most excited for people to see when they go and see Chasing Rainbows?
I'm excited because, like Allegiance, believe it or not, it shares a certain amount of DNA with Allegiance in that they are both serious musicals. That makes it sound like spinach or medicine, but it's simply not the case. They are, but both are, you know, serious stories, and that are serious human stories about people who are not cartoons. We're talking about they're actually about actual people, but who have such a strong emotional life that there is a need to sing. There's so much inside these people that music has to come out of them. And that's what's really been gratifying. You're already in previews for Allegiance right now, and it's been so gratifying to see audiences just embrace the story to their hearts, because I feel like there is an appetite for a authentic joy. I'm just not interested in what feels like empty calories.
Right.
In the theater. You know, for me, it's like church. I want to go a broken person, and I want to be uplifted to a transcendent place, but I want that to be authentic. I want it to be something that I can walk out of the theater inspired and feeling like I have a new tool to live a better life. And certainly the example of George Takei and the 120,000 people who survived incarceration during World War II in the Japanese-American internment camps is so stunningly inspiring to all of us as a team that it's an honor to tell that story. But likewise, like I said, for Judy Garland as well. I mean, it sounds weird to say, like, oh, I admire somebody who, you know, was an addict and you know, died naked on a toilet in London. But, you know, at the risk of sounding like, well, otherwise, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play?
Right.
You know, there was, you know, she packed a lot of life into those 47 years
she
and
did.
Gave an enormous amount of joy and love in the world.
Yeah.
It's easy to forget that.
It's an incredible story. It's an incredible story. And it's so true. I know nothing about her young life. So that would be a whole different dimension about a very familiar person. So that would be great to see. That brings us to Allegiance, which you've referenced. First of all, what is your role during previews? What is it that you do?
I worry a lot.
Okay.
I would say there's actually rewriting happening in previews.
Okay.
So, you know, we are actually, you know, still making changes based on the audience response. The audience is the character that you can't predict. You can only guess. And so once we get that character in the drama, then you make adjustments for them. So yeah, we watch the show. We make the adjustments we can based on how much time you have to be able to do. And we, you know, recalibrate every which way to, you know, try to refine the show. You know, a New York audience is a very unique beast. And while the show was a big hit out in San Diego and broke the box office record at the Old Globe, regardless, you know, San Diego is a different audience than a Broadway audience. So we've been, you know, for the last 3 years while we were waiting for a theater on Broadway, because the real estate is so packed,
right,
we've just been guessing about what we think a Broadway audience, you know, expects and wants. And now we've had a week of previews to be able to get a very good indication of what an audience, you know, does or does not respond to, which confirms, you know, a lot of what we know. And there have been some surprises, frankly, along the way, too. You know, a few things that we said, well, we don't know, we'll see. And, you know, some things, you know, kill and we're delighted. And some things that we thought would be make an impact don't. So you instantly stay up till 3 a.m. and rewrite.
You know, I have to tell you, Mark, I'm fascinated by this sitting here right now. As someone who, you know, look, I grew up right outside New York City and did all my schooling there in New York City and now live other places. There's a part of me that wants to resist the idea that a theater goer is different depending on where you are. But I guess that really is part of your life.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Also, it's not just the theater goer, but it's also the expectation of the theater itself.
Yeah.
You go to a Broadway show and you sit down in one of those historic Broadway theaters,
yeah,
and you have a different expectation of what that means. And for me, at least, I think it's getting back to this notion of serious musicals. There has been, since 9/11, the culture shifted towards musical comedy again, things that were much closer to what the kinds of entertainment you'd see on Broadway in the 1920s. And rightly so, because, of course, after 9/11, you know, New York was in need of laughter. And, you know, the producers and Mamma Mia were, you know, the next two things that really came out of the gate after,
right,
9/11.
Right.
And that impacted, you know, the next, you know, I'd say 10 years worth of what's been, you know, really dominating on Broadway. However, I feel like the pendulum was ready to swing back. Because I think we're ready for now some more protein on our bones. And it's interesting to me to see that we hit the same season as Hamilton, because we've been in development about the same length of time.
Hmm.
So basically around 2007, 2008, there were a number of people who started really putting their attention towards more serious stories, which, if you think about what was happening in the culture, you know, that's when the economy fell through. That was the moment that I actually decided to write for the theater as well, actually,
right,
intriguingly. So there was a serious event that actually, I think, had a sobering effect on the culture. And now, you know, it takes 7 to 10 years for a musical to get to Broadway. So I feel like we're starting to see the net effect of that, you know, because we're in a season that has, like I said, Hamilton, which is a, you know, a very serious show about a historical subject. The Color Purple is back. Fiddler is back. Shuffle Along, which is coming in later this season, you know, is dealing with, you know, a very serious take on racial inequality in the theater. There's an interesting zeitgeist happening right now that's very exciting. It's an exciting season, I have to say, to be a part of.
What happens next? Previews go on, and then at some point we decide, all right, this is where we want it to be?
No, this is true in the theater in all cases, not just Allegiance. Plays and musicals are never finished. They're abandoned. So you just get to a place where you say pencils down and that's the end of that. And so there comes a point where you just say we have to freeze the show because we don't want the actors to, you know, have a mutiny.
Right.
Because we're putting in changes. So there does come a point we just have to say, okay, that's that and here we are. And you hope that you've gotten it to the right level at that point. In terms of what I'm heading towards, I will tell you on a personal note, this experience is not just any old debut for me personally. You know, my partner and I met, I don't know why I called him my partner, my husband, met in New York when I was an undergrad and he was a grad student back in a year called 1986.
A lovely
year. 1986 was, it was a terrible year. Everybody was dying. Broadway was dying. It was the single worst season in Broadway history.
Wow.
You know, literally, you know, partly because, you know, people were dying.
Right.
And we met each other, you know, young, broken, scared people. We sort of clung to each other like on a life raft, and we escaped New York. And we had this westward adventure, and I lived in Portland and, you know, became a journalist and became a novelist and did all the things that I did. But the unfinished business felt like going back to New York to be on Broadway in whatever way that meant. You know, when I first got here, it was, you know, thinking that I would be an actor, but that was actually when I really started seriously writing as well that year. So there was this sense of unfinished business, and it came in part, I don't know why I'm mitigating, it came in a huge way because of the death of my mother 6 years ago. It was one of those very, you know, sort of cliche, if not now, when kinds of experiences.
Right.
So fast forward, moving to New York, determined to get to Broadway, et cetera. And again, talk about whatever is the word beyond serendipitously, our opening night is November 8th, and that would have been my mother's 76th birthday.
Whoa.
Excuse me, 75th birthday. So yeah, it's a very resonant night for me. This is a really interesting finish line.
Wow.
And then I get on a plane the very next morning and go down to work on Chasing Rainbows. I don't stop.
Do you take a break at some point, Mark? I like the part where you take a break. I know today is your day off, and it doesn't feel like it right now.
No. I don't foresee any break anytime soon.
Okay.
As soon as Chasing Rainbows is over, I go to Beijing. I'm working on a project with Jay Chou, who is, no exaggeration, the Chinese Justin Timberlake, and doing that. Then we come back and get ready for Goodspeed's Chasing Rainbows. But, you know, there's nothing else I'd rather be doing.
Nice.
You know, there's no place I would rather be right now than 48th Street at the Longacre Theater. I mean, it's what I always wanted. And yes, it's stressful, but every bit of it is thrilling and interesting. The boring parts are interesting to me. So I'm absolutely thriving and relishing the whole experience. And I'm glad that, you know, I'll be 50 next year. And I'm glad it took this long. Because if I were a younger man, I don't think I could have handled it.
Now, we do not foresee any mutiny with any of your actors there in Allegiance, but I will tell you, not sure if you know this, some pretty amazing actors there in Allegiance.
And, you know, they are held together by the amazing leadership of those actors. You know, there's a tradition in the theater that the leading lady and the leading man really do lead the company.
Yeah.
They are sort of the backstage camp counselors, and they set the tone. So the tone is set absolutely from above with George Takei, who, talk about a life force and a spirit, a man who is fully committed his entire life to making a more perfect union. I mean, you ask him, George, what's your mission? And he will say, to make a more perfect union. I mean, that's what he's about.
Right.
But then he's supported by Lea Salonga and Telly Leung, who, you know, a lot of theatergoers know from either having done Godspell on Broadway or having been on Glee. And the three of them really set this incredible tone because we all are there with a mission. It's not just any show. You know, we are family, and the show is about, you know, one family, indivisible. That is our tagline. It really is what the show is. This is a place where the marketing actually matches the show. But beyond that, you can be a family and be doing Krispy Kreme the musical.
Right.
But we're a family who have a mission to be able to tell a story that pays tribute to unsung American heroes. And it permeates the entire cast, many of whom are related to internees. And of course, the story is based on George's real life story because he was raised in the Japanese American internment camps. So his personal story is what inspired the composer and the producer to conceive of the project to begin with.
Incredible. Incredible stuff. Whoa.
Seen it, though?
Yes, it is. It is. And we have to talk about radio with you. What a radio background you have. I have to tell you my personal Mark Aceto story. My first year of teaching, my first year of being a professor, was in 2009, and students were struggling a little bit with writing, and I needed an entry point to just talk about writing, and a little all things considered story called Who Needs a Manual to Write Real Good, played for them by the one and only Mark Aceto.
Wow.
Look at that.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. Yeah, that was about the 50th anniversary of Strunk and White's Manual of Style.
Yeah, yeah.
For NPR.
No, we go a long way back, Mark. You just didn't know it.
We go a long way back.
You just didn't even know it.
That's amazing. I had no idea. I love that. The NPR, what a great adventure that was.
Yeah.
To be on that show for the few years that I was. You know, just the delight in knowing that people are hearing you in their cars is so much fun.
Yes.
You know, because in NPR, what I learned about NPR, here I'll give you an insider insight into NPR. I've always made fun of NPR because of what I think of as the NPR voice.
Right.
All of the people who talk on NPR talk in that sort of NPR voice. And I thought, what is up with that? And then when I finally got on the show, I discovered what it is. Because the majority of NPR listeners do listen in the car. And therefore, you can't have any highs or any lows to your sound. And they do compress you, but they really encourage you to talk very much in a middle range where your voice neither goes up or down too much, but very much in the middle so that people in their cars can hear every word you say.
Wow.
And if you go, if you go back and listen to all of my NPR commentaries, what you're hearing right now is my natural speaking voice versus Mark Aceto on NPR.
I will say, though, the other thing that you needed to make it big and to keep going, you needed an NPR name. I don't know that Mark Aceto is going to cut it.
Oh, what is there an NPR name game? I was not aware of it.
Oh, yes. Oh, you
is
need
it like having a stripper name? I was not aware of that.
We have to come up with that, you and I. But yes, no, you need kind of a, like some of our past guests, you need to be a Netta Ulaby or a Sonari Glinton or an Ophira Eisenberg. You really need,
That's true. Sylvia Porgiole, right.
Yes.
I will tell you, actually, the cast of Allegiance has made me an honorary Asian, you know, because I'm a white guy who came onto the show with some very real trepidations because I didn't want in any way to be seen as carpetbagging on someone else's story or,
right.
You know, some kind of cultural imperialist. So that meant a lot to me to make sure that, we have an Asian director whose father was interned. We have an Asian composer obviously in an all Asian cast and a lot of other Japanese Americans working on the show. So they just welcomed me into their family and made me an honorary Asian, so they actually now call me Marcus Ito, honorary Japanese-American playwright.
Nice.
So maybe that would be my NPR, Marcus Ito.
I think that might do it. I think that might do it. We got to try that out.
Right, absolutely.
Now, finally, we have to do a little learning annex with Mark Aceto. You teach story structure to my fellow NYU students. What's that one piece of advice? I know we can't boil down a whole semester to one piece of advice, but what's that one thing that all of those students need to know that you have to impart onto them?
What is the spine of the story?
Yeah.
Can you say it in one sentence? If I were to say to you around a campfire or at bedtime, tell me a story, then just tell me a story. And what is that story? The thing about theater is that in a way it is like cavemen gathering around a fire in a cave to tell a story. We enter a dark place and we all sit around a lit area and we watch a story, just people telling us that. And I think it's all too often in the teaching of writing, we forget just to say, just tell me a story.
Yeah. Nice. Well, Mark, I have to tell you, from, you know, NPR, from Who Needs a Manual to Write Real Good to now, it's such a treat to have you on the show. I've been following your career for so long. And my gosh, do you have so many balls in the air right now. It's very inspiring juggling that you're doing, I have to tell you. For everybody who wants to learn more about everything that Mark is doing, including more information about all these incredible projects that are all coming to fruition, you have to stroll on over to markaceto.com. Where else should they go to learn more about these exciting projects, Mark?
You follow me on Twitter, at Mark Aceto.
There it is. I enjoy your tweets, Mark. They're very witty.
Why, thank you. One tries.
There you
one
go.
are we following one another? I need to be following you.
We have to do it. We have to do it. We support each other.
We can continue to banter beyond this experience right now.
As we New Jersey people do. Mark Aceto, an absolute pleasure having you on the show. So many exciting things coming up for you. We're wishing you all the best.
Thank you so much. I'm honored that you asked me to be here. It was a lot of fun.
Simple day outside. The sun is the only thing shining, not a cloud in the sky, no hint of you.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, we have tons of time left on this week's episode to talk about all of the latest LGBT news out there. But first, wishing you all a very happy National Coming Out Day, which was on October 11th. I know it was a few days ago. Hope that you were able to celebrate in your own way. I actually was able to celebrate on our local NPR affiliate here in Cleveland, IdeaStream, and they had a bunch of folks on to talk about coming out. And so I was able to do that for an hour on Monday morning and talk about the history of coming out, which a lot of people don't know. We tend to focus in on the coming out of the closet piece. But before we talked about coming out of the closet, you know, in the 50s and 60s, when we were talking about trying to escape from the stigma associated with being gay, actually in pre-war times, this is part of what I teach, in pre-war times, coming out wasn't just about stigma. It was actually coming out into a vibrant society. Now, it was still pretty secret. It's not like there were these greatly open LGBT groups running around in America, but if you were in the know, perhaps a back of the magazine announcement or through very kind of limited production newsletters, the coming out process was actually kind of like it was in the South, where you're coming out into high society. So it was a badge of honor. And we're kind of seeing that now in modern times. The host, Mike McIntyre, who was fantastic there on that NPR affiliate on IdeaStream, Mike questioned, hey, is coming out easier now? Well, coming out is never easy because it's such an independent decision on your own family structure, on your own support systems. So it never necessarily gets easier because you're still dealing with people in your life and how they are going to respond. But the cool part about coming out now, and you read about this all the time, particularly with youth, is that with all the media visibility on LGBT issues, you're not just coming out to your family, but you're also coming out into this very visible culture that has all of these amazing elements to it, and out celebrities and out culture and music and fashion and all these different pieces that we associate with LGBT culture. So you actually get to come out into a vibrant and visible group. Now, the struggle is always having a sense of history, and I always wanted that. You know, when you come out, you are also given this handbook that lets you know, hey, here's your LGBT history, and we have a really special guest on next week's episode that's developed an app to actually inform people of LGBT history. So people doing work on this, but yeah, coming out has come a very long way. I was so privileged to be able to share the airwaves on that station this past week with a husband and wife who are affiliated with PFLAG, Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays, and their daughter came out to them. I think she came out first as bisexual and then came out as a lesbian after that, just in the past year and a half, and they just spoke of their struggles. And I don't often have the opportunity to talk to parents who are struggling with their child's sexual orientation or gender identity. I tend to work in that direct service kind of way with youth who are coming out into their gender identity or coming out into their sexual orientation to their support system. So what an unbelievable honor and privilege it was to hear from these parents who just stepped up and said, yeah, we didn't respond very well at the start of this. And then we did our research and we sat our daughter down and said, above all else, we love you. We have a learning curve that we need to now address, and there's a lot of research that we need because there's a lot of information that we don't have. But first and foremost, we love you. And then they went out there and they did that research and they did that support system development and found PFLAG. And if you don't know PFLAG, what an amazing organization for parents and friends of lesbians and gays. PFLAG is just doing such amazing work to support all aspects of that family structure. So look up a local PFLAG affiliate in your community. If there isn't one, why not start one? It's a great thing. It's a great thing. I want my mom to be president of PFLAG. My mom has been very open about her journey from when I first came out to her over the phone, which, oh, I wish I had done that in person, but it's the way I did it. I did it over the phone, and how much she struggled with my sexual orientation, coming to terms with that as a parent who was nervous about safety issues, who was nervous about my future because she didn't understand what it meant to have a future as a gay man. She wasn't able to process. I'm the youngest of four. My two older sisters, my older brother, they're all straight. And so it was a very familiar upbringing to my parents, and they were all in very serious relationships at the time that I came out. And so for my mother to be able to process, what does this mean? What does it mean that my son is gay? What is his future going to be? She really, really struggled, and we went through some bad times. But now, oh my gosh, my mom's the best. Hey, she's been on this show. You can stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com and you click on the guests tab and you scroll on down to Terry Schneck and you can hear about my mom. And you can even hear about her talking about her mom, because my grandmother, who passed away about 2 years ago at this point, my grandmother was instrumental in my mother coming to terms with my sexual orientation. My grandmother, Alice Besson, amazing, amazing. I wish I had gotten her on the show. And I actually played for her. I remember sitting in my grandmother's kitchen and playing for her the episode that my mom was on, and my grandmother cried when she heard my mother on my radio show talking about how she, my grandmother, helped my mother come to terms with who I am. Because my grandmother stepped up and she said to my mother, he's the Ken we know. They call me Kenny. He's the Kenny we know. He's the Kenny that we love. That's what it comes down to at the end of the day. So my grandmother, Alice Besson, amazing woman, instrumental in my mother arriving where she is. Those are all my tales for National Coming Out Day, because that was part of my coming out process. But let's get to the news. Exciting news out of New Hampshire. The growing movement to ban conversion therapy, and if you don't know conversion therapy, that is the kind of fraudulent process, I say kind of because it really is a fraudulent process that attempts to change a person's sexual orientation or gender identity. Well, that growing movement to ban conversion therapy just gained what some might consider an unlikely champion, a Republican lawmaker in New Hampshire. Representative Eric Schlein told the Associated Press this week that he plans to introduce a bill that would ban the use of scientifically discredited therapy on minors throughout the state of New Hampshire. Representative Schlein said this, quote, "You can't convert people's sexuality. I think most people get that. I think our culture grows stronger when we're able to accept different people's lifestyles and treat people with honor and respect. I don't think it's radical," end quote. If Schlein's bill is successful when he introduces it in the new legislative session beginning in January, New Hampshire would become the sixth jurisdiction to ban what is sometimes called ex-gay or reparative therapy. And just so you all know, we're all on the same page, that therapy has been denounced by every major medical and psychological organization in the country as ineffective and harmful. Again, let's be clear, conversion therapy has been denounced by every major medical and psychological organization in this country as being ineffective and harmful. So not only does it not change an individual's sexual orientation, but it can do harm. It has been proven to have done harm. Earlier this year, President Obama and the U.S. Surgeon General both denounced the practice as essentially junk science. California Democratic Congressman Ted Lieu, along with House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, introduced federal legislation in May that would ban the practice nationwide for all ages, labeling the practice's false claims about being able to pray away the gay as fraud, subject to investigation by the Federal Trade Commission. In August, and we covered this on the show, Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner became the latest state leader to sign into law a bill that bars licensed therapists from subjecting young people to therapy that is designed to change their sexual orientation or gender identity. In May, Oregon Governor Kate Brown banned the debunked practice in her state, too. These advances followed similar legislation passed in years prior in Washington, D.C., New Jersey, and California. So again, we have Illinois, Oregon, Washington, D.C., New Jersey, and California. Other than those places, and hopefully New Hampshire coming up, that's only a handful of states. There are 40-plus other states where reparative therapy, ex-gay therapy, conversion therapy, totally legal, even though it is ineffective and harmful. So much work to do. Again, yet another reminder, it's not just about marriage equality. I do want to be a little bit critical of The Advocate for 2 seconds. So this story came to us from The Advocate. It's been covered in a lot of different press, but I stole this one from The Advocate. And in this piece where they detail what happens in other states, so let me read this directly to you. In August, Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner became the latest state leader to sign into law a bill that bars licensed therapists. Okay, dot, dot, dot. And then what it actually says in The Advocate, in May, Oregon Governor Kate Brown, a bisexual woman who is the country's first openly LGBT governor. It is very curious to me that we have to remind people at each and every opportunity that Oregon Governor Kate Brown is a bisexual woman who is the country's first openly LGBT governor. It's a great accomplishment, but in a piece like this, it feels like it only serves to tell the readers, hey, this is why it passed in Oregon. Which, that doesn't make sense, because in Washington, D.C., New Jersey, and California, and in Illinois, Governor Bruce Rauner, we're not saying, hey, by the way, these are straight people passing this. That detail is actually, in my opinion, superfluous to the story. Every time Oregon Governor Kate Brown hits the news, we don't need to remind everyone that she's a bisexual woman who is the country's first openly LGBT governor, particularly in all the LGBT-related stories, because it feels like it just tells the readers that, hey, that's the only reason she's doing this. She's in the community, so of course Oregon Governor Kate Brown is going to ban conversion therapy. No, I don't know. I just feel like in that story, we don't need that. We don't need it. On the national news front, we have Ben Carson. Physician and Republican presidential candidate Ben Carson is again talking about marriage equality. He is saying this time that marriage equality will lead to legalized polygamy and that marriage equality already tosses the word of God into the garbage. Ben Carson was speaking to a conservative radio host when he made these comments. He claimed that he, quote, had nothing against gay people whatsoever, end quote, which doesn't feel right. Oddly, Ben Carson wanted to know what he could do to mollify gay people if he refused to change his opposition to same-sex marriage. The radio host said this, quote, "When someone is winning, they want to push us as far as they can," claiming that many gay people are fighting too hard for rights and railing against so-called religious freedom. Ben Carson followed up with the old trope that marriage equality will lead to newer definitions of marriage. He said, quote, "The natural next question is opening up marriage to more than two partners." He continued by saying, quote, effectively, what it does is to take away from the tradition of family we've known for thousands of years, but it also negates an important part of the Word of God. And if you can do that with one part of the Word of God, you can do it with the rest of it too. Toss the whole thing into the garbage. And the radio host concluded by saying, obviously, many people don't care about the Word of God. That is Ben Carson, currently in many polls, tied for Donald Trump to be the Republican contender for the President of the United States, Ben Carson, equating marriage equality with polygamy. There you go. Over in Texas, opponents of the Houston Equal Rights Ordinance, which is an LGBT rights measure that will be put to a public vote on November 3rd, those opponents are continuing to raise the specter of men in women's restrooms, with local conservative ministers calling the ordinance dangerous and damning. Reverend Floyd Williams Sr. of the Antioch Baptist Church was at a rally held by opponents of the ordinance last week and covered by Houston TV station KTRK. He said this, quote, I believe this bill is the most dangerous thing that's ever been orchestrated in the city of Houston. Wow, the most dangerous thing that's ever been orchestrated in the city of Houston. Others at the event called the ordinance, quote, reverse discrimination for people who believe in God, wow, and deadly, decisive, and damning. Those who rallied are members of a conservative pastors coalition that has put together the No on One website, as the ordinance is known as Proposition 1. Its homepage states, quote, your vote no on Houston Proposition 1 protects women's and children's right to privacy in public restrooms, showers, and locker rooms. So apparently we are still doing that, where we are saying, hey, if we pass these protections, it's going to put women and children in danger. So disappointing. The opponents are using the repeatedly debunked claim that access to bathrooms will enable sexual predators to attack women and children, having recently run ads to this effect, and they are now making this the focus of the No on One's website. Such trans-inclusive non-discrimination ordinances are enforced in more than 200 jurisdictions around the country, and there has never been a verified report of anyone. Never. There has never been a verified report of anyone using these ordinances as cover to enter gender-segregated spaces and harass women. If anyone did commit such a deed, the ordinance would not prevent them from being prosecuted under existing law, nor does it seek to do so. That is what's happening in Houston. Oh gosh, just using some tired old rhetoric. It's very sad. Hillary Clinton, following up on her sweeping speech to the Human Rights Campaign volunteers last weekend, Democratic presidential frontrunner Hillary Clinton acknowledged this week that the unabated murders of trans women constitutes, quote, a national crisis. In a private meeting with Black Lives Matter activists in Washington, D.C., Hillary Clinton recognized that the reported 20 transgender women killed in the U.S. this year, most of whom have been trans women of color, signify what advocates have long called an epidemic of violence that Clinton hopes to combat if elected president. Although the meeting was closed to the public, BuzzFeed News reports that trans activist Cherno Biko, who works to support the families of trans women killed, was in attendance and spoke passionately about the fear she lives with daily as a Black transgender woman. Biko told BuzzFeed News this, quote, I think it's really important to have Hillary Clinton's voice as part of this conversation. We need all hands on deck. Ferguson Commission's Brittany Packnett also said this, quote, Hillary Clinton acknowledged that it's not her lived reality. I don't think she offered yet a lot of specifics about how to protect the most vulnerable among us, especially trans women of color, but it seemed like she wanted to do more listening on the topic, which was encouraging. So there you go. Hillary Clinton saying more. By the way, Ben Carson, he's in a lot of different news stories this week. It wasn't just that he equated marriage equality with polygamy, but he has said some other fascinating things as well. In a Sirius XM radio interview this week, he said this, quote, we've got to stop paying attention to the PC police who say every lifestyle is exactly of the same value. No, it's not of the same value. It is very clear that intact traditional families with traditional intact values do much better in terms of raising children. So let's stop pretending that everything is of equal value. He then went on to say this, quote, we need to face the fact that when young girls have babies out of wedlock, most of the time their education ends with that first baby, and those babies are four times as likely to grow up in poverty, end up in the penal system or the welfare system. You know, I'm not making this stuff up. That's well documented. That's a problem. So that was him continuing and railing against single parents as well. That flies in the face of several major long-term studies which have demonstrated that LGBT parents, including parents who are transgender, are just as loving, supportive, and well-equipped to care for and provide for their children. The largest study to date of children raised by same-sex parents determined that those children are actually healthier and happier on average than kids raised by opposite-sex parents. We're not trying to win here. I'm not trying to say that kids of same-sex parents are happier and healthier, although there is research that suggests that. Let's just get rid of the part where we're saying intact family values, which Ben Carson means one man, one woman, that is the best possible scenario and that having same-sex parents will lead to damaged kids because the research says otherwise. So again, we're not trying to win. I'm not trying to win here. It's okay that this research says that, you know, kids of same-sex parents actually can be happier and healthier. We just want to get rid of that other trope where we're saying they are damaged. They are automatically damaged if they have same-sex parents. So ridiculous. So ridiculous. And he's a physician. That's what I don't get. He defines research in a much different way than I would associate with a physician. Over in Australia, way across the waters, an elderly gay couple has been ordered to take down a gay pride flag from their apartment balcony in Port Melbourne, with the body corporate threatening them with legal action if they did not comply. Murray Sheldrick, who's 78 years old, and James Belia, who is 72 years old, received what they said was a nasty email from the Melbourne Inner City Management Property Owners Corporation last week, demanding that the couple remove the flag from their Rouse Street balcony or risk a legal case in the Victorian Civil and Administrative Tribunal. Whoa! The letter, seen by Fairfax Media, warned the couple that they were in breach of the Owners Corporation's rules affecting the, quote, peaceful enjoyment of the other residents. Their pride flag, that rainbow flag, was affecting the peaceful enjoyment of the other residents. The breach was described as, quote, displaying advertising material, and the residents were instructed to remove the flag immediately. It was unclear from the letter what was being advertised, although I guess it's something gay, because we're saying, hey, there's a gay pride flag here. Mr. Belia said the couple, who have been in a relationship for 50 years and own their property, bought the flag in February. They have since complied with the demand and removed it from their balcony. They said they had unfurled it on special occasions, including Australia Day, Queen's Birthday, and the Midsummer Festival, but this was the first time they had received a complaint. The couple wrote a letter to the Victorian Ombudsman last week about the incident, but were referred to Consumer Affairs Victoria. They also contacted Port Phillip Council. They're awaiting a response. They said this, quote, "We are positive it is homophobia. There's no doubt about it. Why else would they bother us? The flag is on a huge terrace. It's not in anyone's view." Wow. I love, by the way, any story that has Murray Sheldrick, 78 years old, and James Belia, 72 years old, who have been in a 50-year relationship, who are just displaying their rainbow flag. Look at that pride that they have. I love that pride. We see so many generational aspects to pride, and I love seeing Murray Sheldrick, 78 years old, and James Belia, 72 years old, with their flag. I hope they win. I want them to be able to put their flag up, because that would be a good thing. That would be a good thing. Now, this is a fun one for me because it's a personal story. Artist Jordan Eagles is getting a ton of press because he has a new art project out there, and it is sparking discussion about the FDA's ruling that gay and bisexual men cannot donate blood unless they've been celibate for an entire year. Jordan Eagles, he feels that this ruling is unrealistic, if not a bit insulting, and his project is meant to call attention to this and to spark discussion about what he calls, quote, blood equality. The project is called Blood and Mirror, and it's been on display this month at the American University Museum in Washington, D.C. On November 2nd, it will move to the Trinity Church in New York City. Blood, for Eagles, is something to be shared. For years, his work has included large-scale, light-based installations, sculptures, and photographs that incorporated the fluid, which he gets from slaughterhouses, as both his medium and his subject matter. His work was rooted in, this is what he says, quote, the abstraction, and sought to explore themes of corporeality and spirituality. And while many gay men read into the work as a commentary on gay blood, Jordan Eagles said he did not have a political agenda. And then Eagles began this new work in 2014 on what would eventually become Blood Mirror, a 7-foot plinth-like vessel is comprised of the blood from 9 gay, bisexual, and transgender male donors, 1 pint from each, and it's encased in resin. And he teamed up with activist and filmmaker Leo Herrera, as well as members of the New York-based DJ duo The Carrie Nation. He organized a group show at the American University. He exhibited Blood Mirror alongside Herrera's film documenting the sculpture's fabrication and profiling its 9 donors. The show provided a context for discussing the band's history and its current manifestation. So you guys should all go check out Blood Mirror. It's a fun story for me because Jordan Eagles is one of my oldest friends. It's so great to see this project getting so much attention. When I was an RA at NYU, Jordan Eagles right beside me as an RA at NYU. We were RAs together, a great friend of mine. I love that he is getting press for this because he's really trying to use his voice in his own way, which I love. That's what we do on the show. We want people to use their voice in their own way to raise up the voices of their LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. And that's what Jordan Eagles is doing, and he's using his art to do it. What are you guys doing? Do what it is that you do. I love it. Last but not least, in Arkansas, a young gay man is going public about his Arkansas church's decision to kick him out for choosing a sinful lifestyle. Dylan Settles posted a letter he reportedly received from Woods Chapel General Baptist Church on October 11th, National Coming Out Day, informing him that they had voted to remove his name immediately from the church membership roll. Their reasoning was the fact that Settles had, quote, made it known publicly of his choice to embrace the homosexual lifestyle. And so that letter is up on all types of social media, so you can check it out. It's really something to read. Settles said this, quote, "I was in awe. I was in so much shock. I couldn't read the rest of it. I don't feel comfortable sitting at pew or sitting beside my parents when all I'm going to see is people pointing their fingers at me because of the lifestyle I chose," end quote. So very sad. It's very sad that we're still at this point where people feel like they have to choose. And by the way, people feel like they have to choose between their religion and their sexual orientation because their church is forcing the issue for them. So that's more than a bit of a bummer. I encourage you to go online and go read this letter that was sent by the Woods Chapel General Baptist Church, which was signed "Expressed in the Love of Jesus Christ." I'm a gay Jew from New Jersey. I am the last person who is in a position to comment on how you express in the love of Jesus Christ, but I don't think this is it. I don't think this is it. That's it for this week's show. Our huge, huge thanks to Mark Aceto. He's got a lot of exciting things coming up. We got Chasing Rainbows. He's got Allegiance, which is on Broadway. You can check it out in previews right this very second. Very exciting. Go check out everything that Mark Aceto is doing. And you guys, you know what to do. Get out there. Go use your voice, however it is that you use it, to make a difference in this world. And while you're out there using your voice, while you're out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay? Cool.
summer night.